intimacy is what I feel like we're lacking as leaders and as individuals on the planet. Is if you didn't get that level of intimacy, that care and that connection, you know, that self-energy really from your caregiver, them giving of themselves, their vulnerable, soft, tender self. That's what creates relational trauma. That's the origins, if you will, of relational trauma. And when most of us haven't had that, all we can do is recreate trauma with our partners, with our children, you know, and with our coworkers and our friends and family.
Do you feel frustrated by reoccurring struggles with self-doubt, hypervigilance, and overwhelm? Especially when you've spent a lot of time and resources healing from these experiences that cause you distress? And do you struggle with trusting the people you work with, whether they're your colleagues, superiors, those in your charge, or even trusting yourself? Behind many of your inner doubts, self-judgments, fears, and insecurities lie echoes from old betrayals or relational hurts. Or there may be some unaddressed wounds from past relationships letting you know they finally need some of your attention. Now, these breaches of trust in important relationships, especially those from parents or caregivers or educators or first loves, former bosses and mentors, all these don't necessarily lose their impact on how you lead and work just because they happened a long time ago. Now, couple your personal experiences with the real-time weight of the world and demands of adulting right now, and it sure makes sense you may feel out of sorts and not yourself. But when you compassionately befriend the echoes of betrayal wounds and breaches of trust in your past relationships, instead of trying to think through them and power over them or exile them, you can help yourself get back on track and move towards a deeper level of self-leadership. I'm Rebecca Ching, and you're listening to The Unburdened Leader, the show that goes deep with humans who navigate life's challenges and lead in their own ways. Our goal is to learn how they address the burdens they carry, how they learn from them, and become better and more impactful leaders of themselves and others. One of my clients' most common questions to me is, why am I still struggling with this? They go on to tell me how much work they've done on issues around self-doubt and insecurity and the traumas they've experienced, the betrayals, the disappointments, the losses, the rejections, and more. They've faced it all. And they emphasize they've done the deep work and they thought they were healed. And then something comes up and they feel like they're going backward. And they tell me these struggles even feel worse now, because they believe they shouldn't be feeling the way they do because it was supposed to be dealt with. My clients continue to teach me that even when they invest significantly in healing from their difficult life experiences, echoes of their pain still show up and cause a bit of havoc, especially when you're doing something new or high stakes, or there's an experience in a relationship at work or in your personal life that's activating, or you respond to a collective trauma experience that taps the echoes of your old wound, and it can bring up old ways of responding or old patterns that impact how you honor your boundaries and your values. The expectation that you should be over this by now when you are human and working with other humans adds to your stress and frustration. When you inevitably find yourself at a trailhead of additional or new emotional work that needs some care, I really wish we would stop beating ourselves up for the struggle and normalize this common human experience. Because y'all, we're human, not machines. When we dare to care and learn and grow means we'll take risks and expose ourselves to challenges that may stir up the echoes in our story. Now, these echoes don't mean that we're not healed or that we're broken. They're just data that we need more support and time to reflect on our actions in life. This common experience is normal and not a flaw, and yet we get frustrated with ourselves and others when we can't pull on our grown-up pants. Okay, I want to have a moment for this phrase because it's been showing up a lot in my work with teams and individuals lately. Like, keep hearing people say, like, I just need to pull up my grown-up pants, or they need to pull up their grown-up pants. And I ask folks like what they mean by it. Now, I know what they mean, but I want to hear, you know, what the meaning is behind that phrase for them. And I see and hear that it comes from a place of frustration when people feel stuck in a relational dynamic at work, like when they're having trouble moving a project forward or there's a lot of conflict. But if folks feel frozen or avoidant or combative, of course, we understandably want them to adult better. But responding to vulnerability and fear and shame with more judgment and shame can feel worse and make things worse. Now, we experience pain and trauma in relationships, and we also experience healing in relationships. And while our job is 100% not to be therapists to everyone we lead and work with, we can absolutely be healing and shed some light on the struggles we witness with some curiosity and boundaries and accountability. And often when we just name the thing that we see happening or name what we experience in that certain dynamic, it can dissipate the struggle immensely, particularly for those who have a long history of their own personal and professional development work and have committed to a life of long-term healing. Sometimes just acknowledging the thing and showing some compassion for experiencing it, saying it out loud and getting a witness can help create some much needed space and relief. And sometimes you just may benefit from some focused support if you find recalibrating difficult. Healing from relational wounds and betrayal traumas often come in stages and seasons. There really is nothing tidy about it. Sorry to be a buzzkill, it's just truth. Even though we see so many people offering these quick fix promises and tidy self-help plans, but I see again and again how post-traumatic relational healing work can also just inspire what you do and what you create. And that's why I wanted to have today's Unburdened Leader guest join me on the podcast. I am so thrilled to welcome back Duran Young to the Unburdened Leader podcast. Duran is a licensed therapist. She's a New York Times bestselling author, a former military mental health officer, and the founder of Black Therapists Rock. BTR is a nonprofit organization mobilizing over 30,000 mental health professionals committed to reducing the psychological impact of systemic oppression and intergenerational trauma. Duran obtained her social work degree from the University of Texas, and she also studied abroad during that time in Ghana, West Africa for 2 semesters, and she created a high school counseling center for under-resourced students. It's just how Duran rolls. Duran's also a highly sought-after diversity and inclusion consultant, working with companies like Facebook, LinkedIn, Field Trip Health, and the YMCA. Duran has become a leading influencer and public figure committed to spreading mental health awareness and improving health equity. I want you to listen when Duran talks about belonging and the impact on us when we don't feel like we've had a place when we were young and how we lead ourselves and others as a result of never really feeling belonging in our homes. Pay attention to Duran's discussion of her focus on self-leadership and notice when Duran shares her belief that if we come from a traumatic background, we absolutely still can experience joy in this lifetime. Now, please welcome back Duran Young to the Unburdened Leader podcast. Duran, welcome to the podcast. Welcome back to the podcast.
So glad to be here with you, Rebecca.
You know, when you first came on the show last year, at the time of this recording, you joined a leadership roundtable with Dick Schwartz, the founder of Internal Family Systems. And I loved our conversation where we talked about cultural burdens and really dialed into the cultural burden of individualism and had a really beautiful conversation about that. And I'm excited to keep up the theme of talking about burdens, but to dig a little deeper on what we in the IFS space call legacy burdens. And I want to start by asking, how do you define a legacy burden? And how do you see these burdens impact how we lead ourselves and others?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Rebecca. I've been describing myself lately as a cultural translator. Mm. So, you know, one of my biggest passions is taking IFS to the everyday person and helping them understand it in a very practical, lived experience way. I define legacy burdens as anything negative that we're passing down and around. Anything that could be harmful, that could be exhausting, that could, you know, create more labor for our fellow human beings. And we're passing, and we've been conditioned into it. It's like a systemic cultural thing. Often I specifically look at cultural burdens, things that we're holding, that we're all holding, things that are invisible as the air and the wind, and we're breathing it in and we don't even know it. So helping us see those things that we're passing down and around, especially to the next generation, as I believe that we all have a desire to be well and good ancestors. And I believe the work that we do around legacy burdens helps us to do that.
Thank you for that. And in addition to the cultural burdens that we can pass down and around, this can be from our family lineage. What are some of the other roots of some of these burdens that we may pass down and around?
Yeah, so as a retired military therapist, I initially came into the realm of PTSD through family dysfunction. Mm. We were noticing that people who came back from military, you know, combat zones were having a increased rate of domestic violence and child abuse and not having enough outlets, positive outlets for that aggression and for that trauma. And so I started to get in touch with that within myself. And I noticed that there were a lot of ways that I was raised as a child to, you know, kind of stuff my feelings down, just be tough, never let anyone see you sweat, never ask for help, and just keep moving forward at all costs. And so I saw that in military members. I started to see the patterns once I retired from the military. I started to see how those patterns of family dysfunction were in most families in the United States of America, and how our culture, as I was saying before, how our culture kind of breeds that. So this lack of emotional mm-hmm. closeness with others, this lack of being seen and being valued and being feeling like you belong in the world and you belong in your home and that you belong in your family and in your community and in your job. There's a huge gap in our country around belonging. And it's not just race, class, and gender. It's also belonging within your own home.
Thank you for that. Yeah, it's so important because, at least in my experience, I think a lot of people are walking around not aware of how much they're carrying. Often that's not even their own. That's been passed down to them. And how do you see these unaddressed burdens? How do you see how they impact how we lead ourselves and others?
Well, again, you know, if you were raised by parents who carried a lot of trauma, whether it be, you know, the trauma of poverty, a lot of people from the Great Depression passed down that trauma, the trauma of military combat, the trauma of hyper-religiosity. So, you know, being very focused on religion and nothing else, right? Hyper-religiousness. That's mm-hmm. seen also as a trauma. There's a 12-step program all actually for these intergenerational traumas now. It's called Adult Children of Dysfunctional Families.
Wow.
Yeah, Adult Children, ACA, Adult Children of Dysfunctional Families Anonymous. And so we know that there's all types of ways that families get, you know, unhealthy, that families can be unhealthy, and how we pass that down to our children, whether it be the way that we handle stress, and emotions and mental health and health in general, things like play and rest, the wholeheartedness that we learned about from Brené Brown, you know, being able to be vulnerable. Is vulnerability seen as a weakness or is it seen as a strength? Most of us, you know, we grew up in families where vulnerability and showing your emotions and being soft and tender was seen as something bad and negative. So that is the conditioning that we're all kind of working against. And that's the burden that it creates in our lives and in our relationships.
Absolutely. I'd love for you to share maybe some of your legacy burdens that have, you know, you've worked through, but also influenced, even inspired your professional and career choices. I mean, You mentioned you've joined the military, you're a licensed clinical social worker, you're a founder, you're a leader, you're an educator, you're so much more. And I'm just curious how the burdens that you have carried have influenced these choices in your career.
Yeah, so I grew up with a mother who had a lot of trauma passed down to her from slavery in a very rural part of Texas, northern Texas. We always celebrated Juneteenth because Texas was the last state to free the slaves. And so with that kind of growing up in your blood, you know, that lived experience of trauma and oppression is something that I was always very aware of. You know, I was very aware of the boundaries between Black people and white people growing up in a rural part of Texas. You know, there was like this silent code that we all knew. I was just in Tulsa last weekend for MLK weekend, which I see as a weekend of service. So I went to do service in Tulsa and really learning about the history there. It was really interesting, the ancestral trauma that remains on that land that no one talks about. That, you know, someone said that they had to become a historian to even learn about the history of Tulsa, and they grew up there. Even as someone who grew up there, this is not something that's taught in schools. You know, we have a history in our culture, in American culture, of not talking about hard things, not talking about things that might be sensitive or delicate, and not having the skills. You know, again, if vulnerability is seen as a weakness, then we don't have the skills to have these conversations in a way that's healing and hopeful and loving with one another. And so I went to Tulsa and, you know, just feeling the energy there and feeling the burden of, you know, not being able to speak the things that are true and the things that you are living every day, having your reality, you know, whether it be for me, it was the reality that my mother was addicted to crack cocaine. You know, that was my reality in growing up in the 80s and 90s. That was my reality. And then the fact that she was, you know, a teen mother of three children by the time she was 19 years old, you know, like very severe poverty and having no support, no access to resources. It was really, really difficult to speak the truth of that reality. And I think there's a lot of shame that goes with poverty, that goes with addiction, that goes with trauma. And I tell people that for me, shame stands for should have already mastered everything. I felt like I should know as a child how to navigate this silent code that no one gave me the rules to, you know, that I was the hero child. I was, you know, my role was to be smart, was to be the one who made it out, you know, the hope of the future. But no one told me how to navigate the emotions that went with that. And so, like you said, it inspired my work so deeply because I felt like, you know, the humanity of human beings when you're in these lived experiences of poverty. So many people around the world experience poverty. And there's a traumatic effect to that. It robs you of certain aspects of your humanity, as the same as it goes with addiction and untreated trauma. That's what I tell people. It's not just trauma alone, but trauma unhealed, trauma unspoken, you know, trauma unacknowledged is what we continue to pass down and only, you know, gets worse from generation to generation.
Thank you for that, Duran. And I want to shift a little bit because I think one of the aspects of legacy burdens happens in trauma, and especially when we experience it in relationship, which is usually when we experience trauma. A lot of people, I think culture is catching up, but still people think it's a car accident or something like that. But there's something particularly nefarious about a relational wounding, a relational betrayal, and the echoes of that in our lives and in our lineage. Take me back to a time when you experienced a relational betrayal. And I'd love for you to share how the echoes of that experience impact how you lead today.
Yeah. So one of the biggest relational traumas, I will say, is that my mother, because of her addiction, she would drop me off at my grandmother's house oftentimes. And it'd be in the middle of the night, you know, she would leave us on the porch and ring the bell and kind of drive off because she knew that my grandmother would take us, but she wouldn't be happy about it. And so my grandmother, I remember very distinctly her opening the door one night and saying, "I wish your mother would get her shit together. I'm so sick of raising her children." And feeling as though I didn't belong anywhere. Like I had no one to support and see me and my suffering and my pain as a child who was stuck in the middle of all of this. And I remember going into the closet and crying. And that was my way of dealing with relational shame for most of my life, even throughout my marriage. My previous marriage, I would go in the closet and cry when I was hurt versus letting someone see me be vulnerable and hurting and in pain. And I think I did that throughout the military. You know, it was always just like, hide your pain, hide your suffering. Don't make a big deal. Don't pass the burden on to anyone else. Just take the burden on yourself. And that became so overwhelming, you know, as I began to approach my 40s, that my body started to decline. My body couldn't tolerate the amount of weight that burden carried, you know, the burden of being alone in the world. That's what it feels like when you suffer from a complex trauma from early childhood experiences, adverse childhood experiences, you know, experiences that rob you of your humanity, that make you feel as though you don't belong on the planet, as though your existence is meaningless, or, you know, and that's often what I saw in the military would lead to depression and suicide. You know, feeling that you have no purpose and you have no place in the world. If you don't have a place in your family, it often leads to, what is my place on the planet? And so when we have a planet full of people who feel like they don't belong here, you know, that's a cultural crisis, in my opinion. But going back to what you talked about, as far as like the early childhood stuff, you know, from the womb, really, all the way up to two, Dr. Erickson, who was one of our founding theorists, he says that the goal of that phase is to either discover trust or mistrust. So we're learning to trust the world, we're learning to trust our caregivers, and we're learning to trust ourselves, really. And our caregivers are teaching us how to trust ourselves and how to trust the world. But when our own caregivers are the one, you know, hurting us, that's when it becomes very complicated. And for myself, when it came to my own motherhood journey, I decided to look at more ancient African principles, such as, you know, the idea of carrying your baby for most of the day, and really attaching and gradually introducing them to the world, you know, recreating the womb as much as possible so that this new spirit, this new life, has a gradual process of learning how to trust the world and trust themselves. And that the book that I kind of mentored or modeled my parenting after is called The Happiest Baby on the Block. And I really swear by that book because it builds intimacy, is what I feel like we're lacking as leaders and as individuals on the planet, is if you didn't get that level of intimacy, that care and that connection, you know, that self energy really from your caregiver, them giving of themselves, their vulnerable, soft, tender self to you, to welcome you into the world. That's what creates relational trauma. That's the origins, if you will, of relational trauma. And when most of us haven't had that, all we can do is recreate trauma with our partners, with our children, you know, and with our coworkers and our friends and family.
100%. You mentioned something I want to circle back to about how you would go into the closet, kind of not have anyone see your hurt and your pain because you wanted to carry the burden yourself and not pass it on. Or because I didn't go to the closet, I went to the bathroom. So when you said that I have like all these memories, I would go to the bathroom and then I would, you know, let my emotion out and get it all together and go back, re-enter the family situation. So the bathroom was my closet. And that stood out to me. There was something in you that said, I got to take this. I don't want to put it on anybody else. And it's mine to carry. Can you say a little bit more about that and how that shifted over the years?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of theories around family roles and family dysfunction. If you look into ACA, you'll learn a lot about family roles. And they talk about the hero child, like the child that takes it on as their burden to transform and change. And I think there's something kind of noble about that. But there's also, again, they don't get the humanity of just being a child, just being able to play and develop your own self energy, your own individuality, was something that I feel like I'm still grieving and working with. And so, the hero child, I think that sometimes a hero child might have a different temperament. And I wonder now if I had a happier temperament than, the rest of my siblings, simply because I was the firstborn. And maybe my mom had more self-energy to give to the first one versus the third one, you know, now that I'm a mother and I can empathize with that experience. I wonder if she just had less to give, the more children, you know, that you add on, which is probably why I also only have one child.
There is something about the roles, too.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that, to the birth order and the roles. And I think there's a lot to that. Yeah. So I think maybe it was just my temperament and, you know, a gift and a curse that I was the firstborn. I was uber responsible. I still struggle with over responsibility. You know, I think a lot of oldest children become therapists and healers and doctors and leaders, natural born leaders kind of thing. I've been leading since my sister was born. She's 1 year younger than me. So I've been leading for a very long time, to the point where it's natural. But self-leadership is what I'm focused on these days. How mm-hmm. do I lead the things that are going on inside of me? How can I be with the inner child that's still there needing things from me versus focusing so much on the external world?
That's the work. That's the work. And the hero child, I got it. No problem. Don't worry about it. I mean, we see this all the time with folks, founders, folks with, you know, high powered positions. And then we also see how that takes them out. They medicate, they try and manage, they comfort, they numb in ways until it's not sustainable. And so I really appreciate you sharing a little bit about your story. And you mentioned something too about that developmental phase that Erickson talks about, that 0 to 2 phase about building trust. What's been your evolution of trusting yourself and others as you are in all these various leadership roles in your life?
Yeah, the path for me as far as trusting myself has meant that I've had to get to know all the parts that don't. Going back to IFS really helped me, internal family system, seeing my system as an internal family and, you know, having all of those parts of my family that, you know, didn't trust themselves either. There was a lot of mistrust in the world and in ourselves. There was a lot of fear of uncertainty, as Brené calls it. And I'm learning to integrate those parts of myself. I'm learning to be with those parts so that they can get to know me and get to trust me. And trust is something I'm learning that you can't rush. You can't have an urgency around the trust process, whether that's with another human being or with, you know, some internal aspect of myself. I'm really learning to trust, you know, the process as well. Having a higher power, going to 12-step meetings, is really trust that things work out, you know, somehow, and that I'm not in charge of all the world's problems. You know, like I said, as a hero child, we develop that over sense of responsibility and not knowing what's actually appropriate for our age and for our capacity. I notice that in a lot of leaders at work, they don't understand what's in their capacity and what's not. And I tell you, what the hardest thing for me to learn was that changing other people is not in my capacity. Even as a therapist, even as someone who specializes in human behavior, you know, it's not my job to change another human being. It is their own work to do.
I love that you said that. It's so funny. Just the other day, I had a client who was frustrated with a long-term pattern with her husband. She's like, can you give me some tips on how to help him become more aware of this? I said, no. She's like, what? She's like, you're not going to help me? No. We could talk about how his choices are impacting you, how to speak, how you feel, and the impact of his choices. Sure. But we're not that. No. And she was just like, shaking a little bit. She's like, okay, I get it now. I was like, no, I'm not going to help you with that.
It's interesting. I've noticed that as a pattern, you know, from parents. That's where that pattern comes from. A lot of our parents use, you know, overpowering as a learning mechanism or a, you know, a way to manage discipline and behavior. So when our children are used to being overpowered, they are going to find someone else to power over, you know, versus giving them, empowering them to explore their power within, allowing them to have choices, you know, allowing them to have autonomy and a voice. I was telling my niece about gentle parenting, and she's like, where was that when I was a child?
That's funny. Gentle parenting. Because the 80s, I grew up in the 80s, and it was like, see ya, parenting. I don't know what it was. It was like, what's in, something's in the freezer, parenting. There was some beauty. I think I still have some, maybe I have to check on that. There was some beauty in some of that freedom, but maybe that's nostalgia glossing over it. I really appreciate, though, the things you're bringing up, because if we experience that as, you know, that's the kind of parenting we experience, we can continue to replicate that. I mean, you and I probably could sit down and talk for a long time about the folks that we've worked with or things that we've witnessed about that, seeing that replicated in schools, in faith communities, in businesses, in nonprofits, and so on, that, well, this, that we just continue to do what we know. It's something that comes up because I think people feel like if they've had this kind of wounding in their story or this, they're still carrying this identity about pushing through, that showing empathy, like a connection with empathy, showing compassion, it just feels so unjust to them. Like everyone's got to suck this up and push on through. And it's just, it's breaking us down.
I mean, I've waddled in that a lot, being retired military. That's
sure.
That's the thing I tell people. I know that very, you know, I'm very intimate with that. What we called in the military, mind over body, that you could, you know, think your way out of anything. but then your body starts to respond to that after a while when you don't have a thyroid like me, or when your hormones are all over the place, or you have some other chronic illness, you know. Is that what we really want to be pushing for? You know, are we pushing to slowly break people down, or do we want to intentionally focus on building them up?
For sure.
And when you have done the work to be with those parts of your own inner child that needed to be built up, I think you have more of a desire to share that with other people. So what I tell people is legacy burdens are real, but we can also transform them into legacy gifts.
You got it.
And there are children all around us who need a patient, loving, gentle, soft adult to just be with them, you know, just see them and hear them. And not that you can change it or you can fix it, but you can allow them to rest in your own self-energy.
It's so true. And we talk a lot about witnessing in the IFS community, the power of just witnessing those parts in us. But man, we just, it doesn't, other parts was like, this is inefficient. I don't want to witness this. This is too painful. And even just with my kids too, I think about sitting with them and their choices. And I'm like, all choices suck right now, but you have choices. So let's walk it through. But even then, before we get to that, it's just like, what's going on? What do you know? And just not even say anything. It's just listening and attuning. And we don't do that well. It's super uncomfortable. I think a lot of folks want to. But then the other side, especially with gentle parenting, I'm seeing this backlash, like the shadow side, where clients are like, I wasn't gentle today. I'm like, are you trying to do perfect gentle parenting? Because that's actually kind of like, what I'm seeing, like now, perfect gentle parenting. I wasn't regulated. Now I feel horrible and my kid's going to be in therapy the rest of their life. I'm like, well, let's just, I mean, your kid might be in therapy, but let's just try and shift like the generational patterns, maybe it's something else. But even then there's this piece of now I have to be perfectly regulated now and I have to be kind all the time versus being authentic. You know, like it's not even kind. It's like this forced, tell me more. And it's like weird because that's inside. They have all this other stuff going on. They're like, my kid, it's a crayon. It's just a crayon. And they keep screaming. Like we're not authentic with ourselves. We don't witness what we're feeling. And then we beat ourselves up if we're not perfect and are forward facing. And I see that translate from parenting to whatever roles folks have outside of the home too. So it's tricky with the pressure that we put on ourselves.
So I look at everything systemically and I see that mothers, very similarly to leaders, there's a lot of pressure from the culture to not be human.
Right.
I experienced that myself. It's like, what do you mean you have feelings? What do you mean you get sad? What do you mean you don't always feel, you know, up for it or at the top of your game? People can really pedestalize leaders and mothers and anything that's seen as a role of admiration and responsibility. But I've been really looking at the gifts of imperfection, you know, going back to that work from Brené Brown. And we actually have a 12-day series coming up, myself and Aiko, who's another Dare to Lead facilitator. We're going to be doing a 12 Days of Gifts of Imperfection, because she worked for Stacey Abrams. And I think also when you're at a very high level, you know, being a captain in the military, we can both relate to this high level of pressure to not be human. And now, like I said, I had to, after I retired from the military, I had to go to the 12-step meeting to discover like how to just be a human. And I tell people 12 steps taught me that human stands for humbly understanding mistakes are necessary. In the military, especially in military medicine. Yeah, in military medicine, it was like mistakes. People die when we make mistakes in medicine,
right.
and especially in the military. And so there was a lot of pressure to try to be perfect at every, you know, at every turn, every angle. And so I've had to really work with that part of me that wanted to be perfect, that thought that perfection was ever possible. And really learning that, humbly understanding that mistakes really are necessary in order for me to learn and grow and to connect to the people around me, because people are definitely not perfect. You know, they don't come in any perfect package, and it can be messy. This world of intimacy and relationships.
It is messy. Like, it just is. You know, I'm reminded of, speaking of Brené Brown, there's a chapter at the very end of her book, Daring Greatly, that doesn't really get a lot of, she did some CDs on it, but it's around parenting. And it was such a gift to me. And it's now part of my mandate, where it's not about being perfect. It's about how we own our mistakes. Perfection is a sneaky mofo, right? And it, you know, as Brené's taught us, it's shame's best friend. It's its right hand. And and so when we see perfection, I'm always like, what's going on? What are you trying to shut down? What are you trying to protect from? And it's just been so actually surprisingly good for me with my parenting, my kids, when I mess up, to go and like, I messed up, and just to practice the reps there. Leading is hard. Leading is also often controversial as you navigate staying aligned to your values, your mission, and your boundaries. Navigating the inevitable controversy can challenge your confidence, clarity, and calm. Now, I know you don't mind making the hard decisions, but sometimes the stakes seem higher and can bring up echoes of old doubts and insecurities during times when you need to feel rock solid on your plan and action. Finding a coach who gets the nuances of your business and leading in our complex and polarized world can help you identify the blocks that keep you playing it safe and small. Now, leading today is not a fancy title or fluffy bragging rights. It is brave and bold work to stay the course when the future is so unknown and the doubts and pains from the past keep showing up to shake things up. Internal emotional practices and systemic strategies are needed to keep the protector of cynicism at bay and foster a hope that is actionable and aligned. When the stakes are high and you don't want to lose focus, when you want to navigate inevitable conflict between your ears and with those you lead, when time is of the essence and you want to make hard decisions with confidence and clarity, then Unburdened Leader Coaching is for you, and where you deepen the capacity to tolerate the vulnerability of change, innovation, the echoes of relational wounding, and doing things differently than you were taught. To start your Unburdened Leader Coaching process with me, go to www.rebeccaching.com and book a free connection call. I can't wait to hear from you. I'm curious, as you know, you've done a lot of your own work while you help others to do that. What are some of your tells or common protectors that come up when the echoes of your relational wounding are activated?
Well, this may be really surprising to some people, but I have a very aggressive side, to say the least. And if you practice or study the Enneagram, then you know that the two, when they go to eight as stress, it can be really big and really scary and really fiery. And so the goal for my personality type is to integrate and take better care of myself so that I don't always feel so pushed to the edge where I feel like I need to, you know, lash out at the people that I care the most about. And so I've been really working hard at that lately. Like you said, the repeat offending part of me that likes the F word a lot. Or will say something really snappy, you know, that later you're like, I really feel bad that I said that, you know. And so, yeah, for me, it's working those edges, the eight edge that I can sometimes have, the harshness that I learned in my childhood and how I learned, you know, that was how everyone protected themselves, was to say something really mean or to, you know, kind of be passive aggressive or I'm not going to talk to you or I'm going to, you know, all these things that I learned in my family and learning how to set boundaries so that I don't have to do that. It's like, I love Terry Real's work. He says that a lot of people who typically or traditionally are stuck in the one down place of shame, when we're activated or when that trauma is triggered, we'll go into a one-up position. Like I can feel myself looking down on someone else, you know, whether it be over political differences, because that's my favorite one. It's like, oh, you don't see things the way I see things. What's wrong with you?
Right.
And now seeing that, you know, that aggressive, you know, it's really like a polarizing part. It wants to push you away. And it works, you know, that when you push people away, you look up and you're all alone. You're in isolation. And so after the military, I had to learn a new strategy of how to be close to people and not constantly push people away. And I'm still working on it.
Me too. I mean, it is, though, such a reflex. It's such a protective reflex. Well, first I want to say I love that you know, one of your tells is anger. I just had Soraya Shamali on the show. I don't know if you've read her book, Rage Becomes Her, but if not, Run, Don't Walk. I think you're going to love it. It's a gorgeous book, and she's an incredible, incredible human. And so anger really is a powerful tell, but man, when it's, you know, and Brené talks about it, it's like it's an activating emotion, and it's a horrible life partner, right? That's kind of my summary of what she says. But I love that you named that. And I think particularly for women, we're taught to exile it until it just explodes. But you said something too about like relearning to be human. And it's amazing how to survive trauma, we have to disconnect from our humanity, right? To dehumanize someone, we have to disconnect from our humanity. To survive it, we have to disconnect. And then the reconnecting process is almost like adulting. For those that have survived childhood or early in life trauma, it just got me thinking of just when we lose our sense of our own humanity and or the humanity of someone in front of us. I mean, it goes dark quickly. And there's something about anger that helps us connect with that. Again, as it's complicated in how we express our anger, all those things need to be interrogated, of course. But, you know, reconnecting with our humanity means feeling a whole lot of shit. But just the humanity piece, you know, there's something about when I sense my anger, I feel alive. But then when I'm swimming in the deep end of it, it's, you know, it also goes dark. I'm curious, when you look back at your body of work and all of the different things you've done in your career, was there like a pivotal moment in your career path and how healing your legacy burdens helped you move forward in ways that were bringing more healing and health into your life?
Yeah, I will say there were two really pivotal moments. The first one, and I thought would be the only, was when I went to Ghana, West Africa in the middle of graduate school at University of Texas. I didn't see, you know, a healthy representation of African people in the curriculum for my master's of social work at University of Texas. So I'm so grateful that I had the opportunity there to go to Ghana, West Africa, and be there for two semesters to really soak in their healing practices and what keeps them well, what keeps them connected, deeply connected to each other, even when they feel like they have nothing else. So that was something that was very pivotal to my perspective on life, my perspective on relationships and family and community, and definitely on my work in healing, especially healing, the legacy burdens of racism. But then I, you know, recently within the last 5 years, I think I've had another pivotal shift where I've discovered psychedelic assisted therapy, which I really do see as the number one treatment for intergenerational trauma. Because when you've been raised with something, when you've been conditioned into something that feels so normal, it feels as normal as breathing, and I tell you not to, that it seems counterintuitive. And so it's like we need a program reset. We need a chemical reset in our bodies often to really, you know, make those shifts that feel completely foreign to our body. So psychedelic assisted therapy is something that's helped me tremendously with my racial trauma, trauma around patriarchy, sexual abuse, anything that felt like it was going to be with me for the rest of my life. It's still with me, but in a very different way. It no longer feels like a burden. And sometimes actually feels like it can be used as a gift.
I had Victor Cabral on the show to talk a lot about his mission with psychedelic assisted therapy and psychedelics plant medicine. And I'm wondering for you and your experience, because a lot of people, like, it's still not legal in a lot of places. There's a lot of great research studies going on, but there's also a lot of folks that are seeing this as big business or maybe a quick fix. What would you say to those learning, listening, that was crucial for you in making your experiences with psychedelics a positive for your healing?
What was different about me is that I'm not your typical quote-unquote drug user. You know, I was a DARE kid. I watched my mom struggle with addiction, as I said. So I was very anti-alcohol. I was anti-every substance. Unknowing to me, the whole time I was addicted to sugar and carbs. I tell people I was taught that mushrooms was drugs and McDonald's was food. So we really have to question everything that we know about what is healthy for our body in this system of profit and hypercapitalism. I think the fact that we've been pushing antidepressants that we know don't often work. Typically, it takes people 3 or 4 different medicine trials before an antidepressant actually brings them any relief from their own depression or mental health challenges. And so the fact that, you know, the things that don't work have been pushed so heavily, we have to question what might work, and especially if it's something that's natural or grown from the earth. So that was the first place that I really started to really question the medical model, in a sense that just because someone's pushing me a pill doesn't mean it's the solution. And I also saw that with the opioid crisis. On my way out of the military, I had a few clients that struggled with opioid addiction. And by the way, they were prescribed those medications. You know, these were medications that were now ruining their lives and was initially given to help them. And being inside the medical system, being a social worker in the medical system, I think paved a way for me to explore these things and gave me a level of privilege to know about what was available to me. And so the first place that I always tell people to start is ketamine-assisted therapy is actually legal. And even in places like, you know, Lawton, Oklahoma, where I currently am in a very rural part of Oklahoma, there's two ketamine clinics here. They're popping up everywhere. And it's because people are starting to see relief from very chronic depression, years of suicidal ideation. You know, they're starting to see very rapid relief from these lifelong challenges. And so we've had to really get innovative and think outside the box on what can help us, because we've known that the things that have been, you know, pushed and heavily promoted for the last 20 or 30 years hasn't really given us the effects that we hoped for.
And one thing that, you know, Victor and you and everyone else who teaches about psychedelics talks about set and setting. What was so important for your experiences in the set and setting that really helped them be positive?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I really push starting off with maybe ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, because it is an emphasis on therapy. There's an emphasis on making sure that there's someone there that is trauma-informed, someone there that, you know, can help you develop a relationship, a trusting, caring relationship, so that you can go to deeper places than you normally would. And when people talk about some of their, you know, recreational use of psychedelics, I tend to shy people away from that, because that's how you know, when you hear of a quote unquote bad trip, it's typically because they didn't have someone there that they trusted, or they were in a, you know, at a party or some environment where it wasn't therapeutic. It wasn't, you know, a healing place. It wasn't someone that can empathize with you. It was just a random place with random people. And that's typically what I've seen when people talk about having a bad trip.
I'm curious, what are those younger parts of you that you've done so much work with? What do they think about you and the life that you're living today?
They really feel like they feel like I became the hero that the family wanted, but not for the family, but for myself. I often look at my life and I'm like, wow, I'm in amazement. I'm in awe, pure joy, often in so much gratitude for the journey. And I just want to share that with as many people as possible. I want people to know that this is possible, that you can come from a background of a lot of trauma and still experience a lot of joy in the same lifetime.
As you wrap up, how has your understanding of success changed since you were younger? And what does it mean to you today?
Oh, I'm gonna look up this quote from who I call Maya Angelou. Success is liking yourself, liking what you do, and liking how you do it. To me, that just about nails it. That is the goal of this phase of life for me. I want to like what I do. I want to like who I am and who I'm sharing myself with, you know, and how I'm sharing myself with other people as a leader, or as a friend, or as a family member. And I want to like how I do things. You know, I think there's a loving way to do things and there's a fearful way to do things. And I used to do everything from a place of fear. And now I'm so intentional and so focused on doing things from a place of love.
Thank you so much. Well, before I let you go, I want to ask a round of quick fire questions that I ask guests. What are you reading right now?
I'm reading a book called The Whole Brain Living by Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, a Harvard-trained neuroanatomist.
Okay. So some light and breezy reading there.
It's very compatible with the IFS lifestyle. Yeah.
Nice. What song are you playing on repeat?
Cozy by Beyonce.
I had someone else just bring up that song the other day. What is the best TV show or movie that you've seen recently?
Recently, we're stuck on repeat with my 5-year-old niece on the Disney movie Elemental, which is teaching me a lot about fire and anger.
Love it. What is your favorite 80s piece of pop culture?
Anything Madonna. That always brings me right back to the 80s and the nostalgia of pop music and cross-cultural connections and everyone coming together.
Absolutely. And she's going on tour this year. What is your mantra right now?
Oh, I don't really have one. I would say I have quotes. You know, I live by the words of our ancestors. And I guess this is a mantra, some people would say, but we are our ancestors' wildest dreams. Each and every last one of us, wherever we are on the planet, I believe that, you know, our ancestors did a lot for us to be here and be present in this time and this space. And I truly believe that we are all living the manifestation of the dreams of our ancestors.
It's beautiful. What's an unpopular opinion that you hold?
That everything will be okay. You know, especially in times like right now, politically, and I truly have to believe in gritty faith. I have to believe that everything will be okay, even when it looks like it won't be.
I appreciate that. Who or what inspires you to be a better leader and human?
I would say, as I mentioned before, Dr. Maya Angelou, who was also a mentor of Brené Brown and Oprah Winfrey. So I feel like I'm in a well-supported connection and circle of amazing women who are doing amazing things in the world, and largely how I've gotten to connect with you. So I'm grateful.
Likewise. Duran, thank you so much for coming back on the show and for another just really important and powerful conversation. If folks wanted to connect with you and your work, how can they find you?
I would recommend following us on Instagram. We do have a brand new TikTok channel that we're building up. So follow us there if you're on TikTok. Black Therapist Rock on Instagram, Black Therapist Rock on TikTok and Facebook. We also have a website, www.blacktherapistrock.com, or you can follow Duran Young, LCSW, on Facebook.
Duran, thank you so much for your time and sharing so much of your heart and your wisdom. I really appreciate you.
Thanks for having me.
I want to make sure you take some of the incredible words of wisdom shared by my unburdened leader guest today, Duran Young. Duran is one of those leaders who often has me busting out my notes app when she speaks, while simultaneously leaving me in tears of gratitude. But she's so freaking good at naming things that I've struggled to name and speaks just truth with such power and love. And in our conversation, Duran shared how relational trauma can cause us to see vulnerability as weakness. And if we have that lens, we won't have the skills to have hard conversations in a healing way with ourselves and others. She also noted how unhealed trauma that stays unspoken and unacknowledged snowballs, not only through us and those we love and work with, but through the generations. And Duran noted that one of the main casualties of relational trauma is our capacity for intimacy and connection, which can lead you to recreating these disconnected experiences in work and in life. How do relational wounds impact how you lead today? Are you hard on yourself for not being over past struggles that keep showing up? And what shifts do you want to make in how you lead yourself so you can build more capacity for vulnerability? One of the most insidious aspects of trauma comes from your relational wounds, like betrayal and neglect. And we can counter the impact of our relational wounding by choosing to befriend, witness, and heal those wounds and their echoes. And this is the ongoing work of an unburdened leader. Thank you so much for joining this episode of The Unburdened Leader. You can find this episode, show notes, and free Unburdened Leader resources, along with ways to work with me at www.rebeccaching.com. And I'd be honored if you left a rating, a review, and shared this episode with those you think might benefit from it. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you to the team at Yellow House Media who produced this episode.